Hebrews chapter 7, this starts on page 1004 in your pew Bibles. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, king of righteousness. And then he is also king of Salem, that is, king of peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. See how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these are also descended from Abraham. But this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. In the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one whom it is testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who received tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek rather than one named after the order of Aaron? For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well. For the one of whom these things are spoken belonged to another tribe, from whom no one has ever served at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, and in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. For it is witnessed of him, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." For on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. And it was not without an oath, for those who formerly became priests were made such without an oath, but this one was made a priest with an oath by the one who said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, you are a priest forever." This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. The former priests were many in number, because they were prevented by death from continuing in office, but he holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weaknesses as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. This morning we are continuing our sermon series for the season of Advent, where we are asking the question each week, why did Jesus need to come? What caused him to need to come here rather than as God sort of snapping his fingers in heaven and making things everything better? Why did Jesus need to come? And we're looking at a series of texts in the book of Hebrews to at least in part answer that question. Last week we looked at how Jesus became the final prophet to speak a better prophetic word. And this week the answer that we're looking at is about how Jesus came to establish a better covenant. And as you probably gathered as we read this text already, the issue of establishing a better covenant has to do with the issue of the priesthood of Jesus. Now, if you didn't perhaps grow up in a Catholic church where they do have priests, you may have gone your entire life without ever really knowing anyone who has the title of priest. So what is a priest? Let's answer that before we sort of dive into our text this morning. At the most simple way I can explain this, a priest is someone who mediates, who goes between God and human beings. So in the Old Testament, under the Old Covenant, which was established by the law of Moses, the priests were the people whom God drew out of the nation of Israel and gave them a status that allowed them to come into the holy places in the tabernacle or in the temple. You cannot simply saunter into the holy places of God because of your sin. God's holiness is such that it would strike you dead and consume you in a moment. But he drew out a certain group of people who would represent all their brethren in the nation of Israel. They would bring their prayers before God in the holy places. They would bring the blood of the sacrificial animals that the people would bring into the holy places. And once per year, the high priest was allowed to come all the way into the Holy of Holies to secure atonement for the people. But the priests weren't simply a mediator between God or between humans and God. They were also God's mediator to represent him to the people. So when the priests would come out, they would pronounce the benediction. One of the reasons we pronounce the benediction at the end of every service, it's called the Aaronic blessing. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord make his countenance shine upon you and give you peace. Lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Excuse me, I should know that by now. The reason we do that is because that's what the priests would do to put God's name on his people. Okay? Priests represent us to God and God to us. Let me get at this another way through a story. This last week, I was the honored guest of Brian Reed on Offutt Air Force Base. Okay? Offutt Air Force Base is not something that private civilians simply saunter onto. That is a very secured place. It probably has something to do with, you know, the command of our nuclear weapons and things like that. You don't simply wander onto the base. In fact, Brian was mentioning to me that a couple of years ago, and you can look this story up, there was a guy who broke into the base and was sort of speeding around. And as he was coming, passing all of these signs that say, no trespassing allowed, the use of lethal force is authorized, he was shot as he was trying to leave. It's not a place that you simply saunter under. So I was getting nervous as I was going onto this base. He just sort of mentioned it in passing. I was freaking out. So he comes and picks me up in his full military fatigues. You look great in those, by the way, Brian. He comes and picks me up. And I said, so do I need my ID or something? He said, no, you're not going to need that. And so he pulls out his ID, presents it to the guard. The guard looks right at me. I'm certain a strip search or something is happening, coming soon. Looks right at me, just ignores me, hands the ID back to Brian. They salute each other, and we continue on our way. And I said, Brian, that's like a sermon illustration or something. And in fact, it was. Here we go. I'm a preacher. I can't let that go. So what happened was, why was I allowed standing on that base? Why did I not suffer the fate that that trespasser did? Well, it had nothing to do with my standing, but it's because I was with Lieutenant Colonel Brian Reed. It was a big deal. I said, I've never had a military escort before, and he said, I know. And to get a lieutenant colonel, you usually have to be a full bird colonel, which is, he explained all the rankings. So it was a really big honor. But that is a really good representation of what a priest does, their function. They have the standing to bring us into the holy places of God, the places where we on our own are not permitted to go. So as we dive into this text, here's where I want to start. I know just a moment ago I acknowledged that probably none of you in your life maybe have known, or some of you in your life have not known a single person who had the title of priest, but I want to tell you almost certainly you have priests in your life. And from the Word of God, I want to tell you that your priests, the priests that you look to, are weak and useless. Your priests are weak and useless. Let me tell you where I'm getting that phrase from. Look at verse 18 in chapter 7 of Hebrews. For on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness. The commandment is the commandment of the covenant, which established the Levitical priesthood. The author of Hebrews is saying, that was found to be weak and useless. Okay, so, weak and useless, how? What does that mean? Well, the priesthood wasn't simply just to sort of go between God and humans forever. They actually had a standard they were trying to hit, a responsibility, a goal. And if you are a priest, your job, you got one job, your job is to make other people perfect through this process of going between God and human beings. Here's where I'm getting that from. Look at verse 11. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek rather than one named after the order of Aaron? So perfection was the goal. And this is a rhetorical question. What need would there be? The point is, there was a need because the Levitical priesthood was weak and useless, and therefore it had to be set aside because it didn't make people perfect. Now, when I say to be made perfect, you're probably thinking in a moral sense, to be morally perfect, and that's certainly part of it. But the word for perfection in Greek, the root word is telos. Maybe you've heard of teleological or things like that. It's the idea of bringing something to its completion, its goal. The Westminster Shorter Catechism, you may know, the first question answers this. What is man's chief end? What is the purpose for which we exist? What is the goal that God is bringing us to? Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. The responsibility of the priests is to bring all of us to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Well, the Levitical priests were weak and useless. And what this tells us is if the Levitical priesthood, which is established by God himself, which was perfect in and of itself, just weak and useless at bringing other people to perfection, then how much more are your priests? Okay, I keep talking about your priests. What am I talking about? You have no one that you would call a priest. Well, this is a tricky thing. This is actually a very subtle thing in our lives. You may have heard about people, Christians, talking about the idolatries that we have. Okay? You've heard of this? It's not that we think that all of you go home and sort of bow down to some shrine you have in your basement. And if you do, please come talk to me afterwards because we need to chat. But idolatries we have, these are the things that we want. Paul says that whatever we covet, we idolize. In Colossians 3, verse 6, he says, put to death covetousness, which is idolatry. If you want something, if you expect that gaining that thing, whether it's a relationship, whether it's money, whether it's a career, whether it's some standing or something like that, whatever you want inordinately, thinking that there you will find your satisfaction and your peace and your happiness and your joy, that's an idolatry. Those are relatively easy to spot. The things in our lives that we assign a priestly status, though, are a little bit more subtle. Because in this case, we still want God most. We still are trying to find favor with God, trying to glorify and enjoy God. But what happens is we look to things in our lives that we feel will give us standing before God. So here's how this often looks. Very often people will say, well, I think God accepts me, he loves me. I think I'm fine with God. Why? Because I try to be a really good person. When you say that, you are assigning your morality a priestly status, thinking that you can appeal to your morality. God will look at that and say, fantastic, this is a good person. Come into my presence. Come all the way into the Holy of Holies. But of course, our righteousness is like filthy rags, and it's not good enough. That priest is weak and useless. Or maybe for some of you, see, the thing, this is hard because these are good things. Some of you are looking to your family life, your marriages, the way you parent your children. You're saying, if I can just get that right. Don't pay attention to any of this other stuff on the margins, but if I can just nail this part of my life, then God will see that and recognize how hard I work, what a good person I am. That means you're assigning your marriage or your parenting or where you educate your children, how well you do in homeschooling or sending them to a Christian school, good things, But when we look at those things and say, by that God will know that I am worth it, that I am acceptable in his sight, that's assigning that a priestly status in your life. These things are hard to recognize because we don't always realize that we're doing that. Or what about your political activism? See how hard I work to eradicate this or that? What about your theology? As long as I have every jot and tittle of the Westminster Confession of Faith, I'm good to go. Again, these are good things in and of themselves. But they're weak and useless as priests. Your priests are weak and useless. And let me say another word. Some of you will look to me, or perhaps one of the ruling elders here, or collectively, saying, if my pastor thinks I'm a good person, then I'm good to go with God. My pastor has some special access, doesn't he? That's part of the ordination. You get some special access. No, I am not a priest. I have no special access to God. Trust me. Really, seriously, trust me. I have nothing more than you have, because all of us, at some level, are called priests in the New Testament. We're called a holy priesthood in 1 Peter 2 in two places, and we're called a kingdom priest to our God and Father in Revelation chapter 1. All of us in some sense are priests, but not in the sense that I have some special access to God. I'm simply a different role in the body. I'm not a priest. I'm a pastor. I'm a shepherd. I'm a leader. I'm a feeder. I shepherd the flock that Jesus is the good shepherd of. So if the Levitical priests are weak and useless, and that's a perfect system, how much less, more weak, more useless are yours? Your priests are weak and useless. That's the problem. That's the problem. And in verse 19, the law made nothing perfect. So if that's the problem, what's the solution? The solution, if you missed it, is that Jesus has become the guarantor of a better covenant. That's what it said in verse 22. And I'm going to sort of summarize this, and if you want to come to the Ask the Pastor class next, we can talk way more about Melchizedek. He's fascinating. And way more about some of the details and the intricacies about the argument that the author of Hebrews is crafting here. But let me simply summarize what he's saying, try to get to the main points. He's saying Jesus has come to be a better priest. And here's how we know he's a better priest. Number one, he's after the order of Melchizedek, not according to the Levitical priesthood. And you say, well, that's self-evident, right? Melchizedek? Way better than the Levitical priesthood, right? Well, let's look at what he's saying here. He says that this weird thing in verse 3 that sort of causes us to scratch our head, verse 3, he, Melchizedek, is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. So is this saying that Jesus didn't have a father, or that Melchizedek didn't have a father or mother, that he wasn't born, he didn't die, that he has no ancestry, no one after him? Well, no is the answer to that. Melchizedek certainly had a mother and father. He was born, he died. He's no longer around living physically in that sense. But what this is referring to is that if you were going to be a Levitical priest, you had to have your I's dotted and T's crossed about the perfect genealogy. Your father had to descend directly from Aaron. Your mother had to be of a specific standing. And if you couldn't produce the genealogies, as happens in the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah, we read about the same thing. You had a group of people who thought they were priests but couldn't produce the documentation demonstrating their genealogy. They were told to refrain from partaking of the holy things until they could establish the priesthood again. This is when they were coming back from exile. And cast the Urim and the Thummim to determine whether God would say, these people are priests, okay? It was a big deal. But Melchizedek is not based off of bodily descent. In Genesis 14, where Melchizedek, he just comes on the scene, and he meets Abraham. And what does he do when he meets Abraham? Well, he brings him bread and wine, and then he blesses him. He blesses him. Now, as the author of Hebrews says in verse 7, it's beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. I mean, imagine if you were in Washington, D.C., and you saw the president, and you blessed the president. That'd be nice. I mean, that'd be good, honoring, respecting the governing authorities. But what if the president then turned to you and did that to you. Well, that's a big deal, right? That makes more sense. He has the power, actually, to do something for you, to enrich you in some way. Abraham, as big of a deal as he was, submitted to receive the blessing of Melchizedek. That's weird. That should raise our eyebrows. Abraham is the beginning of the people of God called out of the world, and yet he receives the blessing of Melchizedek. Not only that, but Abraham actually takes a tenth of all of his stuff and gives it to Melchizedek. He gives a tithe to Melchizedek. Well, that's what the Levitical priests were supposed to do. Remember, Levi is the great-grandson of Aaron. So somehow there is another priesthood, another basis by which people can be named priests, other than the Levitical system. And it's superior to the Levitical system, since Levi's great-grandfather was being blessed by Melchizedek and giving tithes to Melchizedek. And somehow we don't have his genealogy. It's not on the same basis. And more than that, we see that there's an oath that goes along with it. If you look at verses 20 through 22, and it was not without an oath. For those who formerly became priests were made such without an oath. The Levitical priests had no promise. They were assigned this task of making people perfect, but they never had God's promise that they would be able to succeed at it. They were simply given the job responsibility. You ever had a job like that, where you're told to do something and knew that you couldn't actually get it done? The Levitical priests did. But Melchizedek and the priest who was to come after the order of Melchizedek was given a promise. The Lord has sworn, this is from Psalm 110, verse 4, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. There's a promise. This priest, after the order of Melchizedek, is going to succeed. But not only that, this priest is a priest not because of his genealogy and his descent. He's a priest because of indestructible life, it says in verse 16. This priest would be raised from the dead. Not only that, but this priest would not be prevented by death, verse 23, from continuing in office. Some of you have had pastors, elders, something that seem to have come into your life and made some progress with you, but then they vanished, and so there's perpetual revolving door. Even the best pastors at some point die, right? That's because they're not priests. But Jesus, because he has been raised from the dead, he's never going to stop being your priest. And therefore, consequently, here's where all of this is leading. Consequently, he, Jesus, is able to save to the uttermost. He is able to save to the uttermost. Where other people couldn't make you perfect, where other priests could not make the people they served perfect, Jesus, look at verse 28, is the Son who has been made perfect forever. He's received it. He's accomplished it. He's achieved it. You want perfection? Jesus has it. He is the better priest. All of the priests who came before him couldn't accomplish it, but Jesus can. That's why he needed to come, to save us to the uttermost. So the bad news is our priests are weak and useless. The good news is Jesus has come to be a better priest, the guarantor of a better covenant. What do we do with this? Let me direct you back to verse 25. I want to just focus on one application this morning that I think addresses a lot of the issues that we struggle with. Look at verse 25. Consequently, he, Jesus, the priest after the order of Melchizedek, is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God. Jesus is able to save you to the uttermost. Those who draw near to God through him, looking to him as priest, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Do you remember singing that earlier? A great high priest whose name is love, who ever lives to plead for me before the throne of God above? That's the verse that this is coming from. He always lives to plead for you, to make intercession for you. Now that may sound to your ears like he's saying, man, Jesus has a ton of spare time. He's living forever. He has all kinds of time. I'm sure on occasion he can find some time to carve out of his schedule to pray for you. But that's not what it says. The force of this is that he always lives. In other words, the full force of his resurrection life is taken up in interceding for you, in praying for you. The Puritan Thomas Goodwin put it this way. He's summarizing the posture, the attitude of Jesus. When he writes this, as though these were the words of Jesus saying, for if I spend my blood for you, will I not spend my breath for you? Here's the thing I want us to think about. There is a real sense that we all struggle with to feel that God merely tolerates us. Imagine that you do something and you get thrown in prison and you are trying to find someone who can come and bail you out. Okay, imagine that. And all of your friends you know are out of town for some strange reason. Maybe they're at the convention that you couldn't go to or something like that. You have no one to turn to. And you know that maybe there's that acquaintance that you have from work who might be willing to come and bail you out. Not because you and he have a particularly good relationship, but that's just the kind of person that person is. And so you call this person, and you can see, I mean, they're like, okay, your name is what again? But they come, and they bring the bail money and get you out. And you can see that, like, they just sort of feel obliged to do this. And then sort of in the ensuing days, it's really super awkward. Any conversation, you see, this guy sees you coming and he walks the other way because he doesn't want you to think that he's going to be around to bail you out again and again and again. That's kind of how we feel about Jesus. That he's the acquaintance who, just because he's a good guy, came to die for us. And it was sort of a thing of obligation, but now he's like, okay, leave me alone, right? I died for you, right? What more do you want? When in fact, Jesus spent his blood for you, and now he always lives to intercede for you, to save you to the uttermost, to bring you to the completion, to the perfection of where you can glorify God and enjoy him forever. Why? Because he is the priest who has the standing you need. He is the one who has accomplished all things, in whom the Father was well pleased. When he speaks at the right ear of his Father listens. He's not merely a lieutenant colonel. No offense, that's a great rank, Brian. He is the commander-in-chief of the armies of heaven. When he speaks, he has the full ear of his Father. And what's he saying? He's saying, forgive them, save them, transform them, conform them, because he loves you. Jesus is the priest who will see to it that you will be saved to the uttermost. And that's going to be painful and difficult and messy in this life. But he promises that in the resurrection, where he's the first fruits who's gone before us, he will bring us all the way home. This approaches the way we look to cover our sins. This touches on the wisdom that we look to and how to live life. This touches on every conceivable aspect of what we do to commend ourselves to God. Stop looking to your priests. They are weak and useless. Look instead to Jesus. Pray with me. Heavenly Father, we confess and acknowledge that we have things that we look to that we think will merit our entrance into your kingdom. Oh, Father, forgive us. Put those to death, so that we can be freed to gaze directly upon Jesus, to receive the forgiveness that he offers, the hope, the better hope that is in him as the guarantor of a better covenant.